Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team.
Hey founders, my name is Av Duryani, and thanks for joining another session of Startup Circle, where we feature successful entrepreneurs with whom we share advice that you can apply today to move your business forward. Like I always say, no matter where you are in the world, if you'd like for us to feature your idea, your startup, your company, if you'd like for us to help you move the needle, join us below, follow the instructions. We truly look forward to making that happen. We truly look forward to contributing to the success of your venture. Our partner for the session is Needles. Needles is a product that allows you to create, iterate, and optimize Facebook ad campaigns automatically and seamlessly thanks to its innovative technology. Aaron, thank you very, very much for being here.
Hey, happy to be here. Always love talking about entrepreneurship and outbound sales and how to grow companies or not grow them, the mistakes people make.
So Aaron, you need no introduction. You've helped so many companies, so many multi-million dollar companies, 10 to 100x their revenue using outbound sales techniques and strategies. You've led teams. The topic for today, Aaron, is how to do outbound sales the right way. So I guess the first question is, what would you consider a right way of doing outbound sales, and would you consider a wrong way of doing it? And then we'll get into the details from there.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, I think a lot of people have heard of me through predictable revenue, but actually you'd be surprised of your list, but there's a lot of people who haven't. Now, as a sales Bible, it goes into prospecting. But one of the things I think we want to start with is the idea that outbound prospecting can be in a very predictable way to create sales appointments. And if you can create predictable appointments, then you can create predictable revenue, but it's not for everybody. So the first place I start with is, depending on the kind of company and your stage, should you be doing outbound sales or not yet? In fact, so this, if you haven't seen it, this is the newer book with Jason Lemkin called From Impossible to Inevitable. And that's one of the topics in here, which is if you, so for example, here's some reasons that you would want to do outbound sales. And at some point you do need to do it, just the right time. But if you have probably at least $500,000 in revenue so far, you've got maybe, or paying 10 paying customers. Let me rephrase it. Here's where you can do outbound prospecting and expect to make money with it.
Okay.
So you've got something to sell. All right. You've got at least 10 paying customers. So you have some data to know, ooh, who should you go after and like what should you expect. You have a deal size or at least a lifetime customer value of at least $20,000, $10,000 or $20,000. That might look like a monthly amount of, and this depends on how long you keep them, at least several hundred dollars. You know, probably better is like $500 a month or more.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you... you know, as long as you have a profitable sale, you can make money at outbound. You're in a market that's not incredibly commoditized. So for example, things like website design, incredibly commoditized. Another example would be if you're not differentiated from everything out there. So these are some of the reasons around, let me restate this. You do want to do it if you are differentiated, if you have a good deal size, if you have some traction and you want to accelerate it. Some reasons you wouldn't want to do outbound, again, you're in a competitive, it's hard to stand out in a commoditized market. You're not really differentiated. You haven't nailed a niche. You have a small deal size. So like you might sell just to small businesses that they're spending $20 a month or $50 a month or $150 a month. In those cases, you can do outbound as a way to learn, as a way to go talk to people, get customers, but you're not going to make money at it yet. So in other words, I want to do outbound and I want to make money is different than I want to do outbound as a way to get some traction and learn and start to do something, but I may or may not make money at it yet. So that's where we start. Are you a good time or not for outbound sales? But at some point, everybody does it. Like for example, did you know that Facebook does outbound?
I'm going to hypothesize that they do.
They do, yeah. And surveying, like all the biggest inbound companies in the world, like SurveyMonkey does outbound.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook has an outbound. Slack either has one or is going to build one. So at some point, everybody does it. the way you use it might vary company to company. It's just, you know, when's the right time. So that's the first step in doing it the right way, is not doing it the wrong time where it's a waste of money or having the wrong expectations.
So Aaron, actually, it's funny you mentioned website design earlier, because Yond right now is helping website web design and development companies generate leads by connecting them with the right customers. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I think all those website design companies need it. There's lots of ways to generate leads. Referrals is obviously, for any kind of services business, like thought leadership or content marketing or referrals tend to be the best, because those kinds of ways to generate leads, you can take advantage of your personality. You can take advantage of your portfolio. You can take advantage of some of your expertise. It's harder with outbound, because with outbound, you have to be so, it's really hard to take advantage of soft skills or expertise with outbound. With outbound, you need to have more hard numbers. So, for example, if you are in website design and you're the kind, though, you specialize in e-commerce, and you can say, hey, you know what, we redo your e-commerce site for other companies, we've increased their shopping cart conversion rates from 5% to 10%. We've made them money this way. That's a lot easier to do outbound for. Mm-hmm. What is hard to do is, we're a website design company and we can make your brand look better. Like, that does not work in outbound. So it's sort of the softer, the fuzzier, the more vague your products are, the harder outbound is to make it work. And the more you need to rely on things like content marketing, referral marketing, or other specialized ways to generate leads and connect with people who'd be interested. So is it impossible? No, it's not impossible, but it's harder. So outbound, like everything else, it's a spectrum. You know, 1 to 10, would outbound be a slam dunk for you? You know, a 10 out of 10, or would it be really, really hard, a 1 out of 10? So a website design company that is more graphics and makes your website pretty, which is valuable, mm-hmm. be harder. It's like a 2 out of 10, it's challenging. If you had a website design company that makes people money, and it's very concrete, a lot easier. It's like more towards that 10 out of 10 or like 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10. SaaS products, right? It's hard. It's easier to sell a product. It's just like, it's a thing. People like to buy things. Services are a little fuzzier. It's hard to understand. Not bad. It's just, again, more challenging, which means, again, step two, thinking about outbound, how to do it the right way, is expectations. Should you do it? Yes or no? If you do it, how will it take to get some results? How long will it take to make some money at it? It's not 2 months. It's not 3 months. I mean, most companies, it takes to get to revenue, might take 6, 9, 12 months. Like, this depends on deal sizes and sales cycles. If you have a 6 month sales cycle, you're not going to see revenue in 4 months. Now, it sounds like common sense, but in the anxiety driven, like when a CEO is desperate, it happens more often than you think. Just as, hey, they do outbound, they hire someone, they hire an outsourcing company. It's 4 months in, they're paying money, thousands of dollars a month or whatever the amount is. And they're like, where are my deals? Where are my revenue? Well, your sales cycle is 6 months. Mm-hmm. But they're just desperate. Yeah. So this is where you have to go in thinking, if you had a really fast sales cycle, 2 weeks, okay, you may be in a few months, you know, you could, things can happen fast, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, you could see some revenue, but most companies are, it's going to take a lot longer than that. And one more thing is to consider, if you're, all your inbound leads, if you've read predictable revenue, I have a copy here, remember seeds, nets, and spears. It just means that there's inbound leads through marketing, usually there's word of mouth leads, and there's outbound prospecting leads, and they're different, which means the sales cycles can be different. So again, one example is, if you're just used to people coming to you through referrals and it's a 30-day sales cycle, you're like, great, we're going to do outbound, right? We'll build a team. In 3 months, we'll have people. It'll be a 1 month sales cycle. So by month four, we should see revenue. No, 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 no. Referral sales cycle is going to be much faster than outbound, that could be twice as long, three times as long. you don't know what that outbound sales cycle will be, except it will be longer until you go through them and then you have some data to know. Because right? Referral, I know they just, that's the best kind. It's easier. They're going to be like, yeah, sure. Bob said to buy, so I'm going to buy. Outbound, they're like, who are you? There's a more of a process to get to know you. So you just have to be prepared for it to take longer than you think and cost more than you think to get to the point where you're making money with it. But once you are, the amount you can make could be higher than you think.
Aaron, I want to actually go back to the soft between hard, the difference between soft and hard, I guess, value addition of, of your company. You mentioned that when it comes to web development agencies, for example, or web design agencies, it's kind of hard to quantify, I guess, how you're going to improve this potential or future customer's business. So does that mean that if you were to approach, if you were to do outbound sales for companies that have soft value addition, that you need to find a way to quantify your contribution in your sales pitch?
If you, as much as you can, yes. Or what we talk about is called concrete details or tangible results. So I would highly encourage everyone, like the thing that was missing from predictable revenue is the first chapter of the Impossible book. So this, that's, I know it's a long title. It's this one, The Impossible to Inevitable. And you can get it for free. There's this chapter you can get for free at fromimpossible.com. You read it called Nail a Niche. Right? And also this is a chapter that's changed how they think about their business. It's kind of like product market fit. It's kind of like crossing the chasm, but in a more systematic way to understand, you know, when you are talking to customers, when this is what I've learned through outbound. If you're reaching out to customers and they're not quite getting what you do, why? If they're not responding, why? And what, how do you nail a niche so that you know the kinds of customers who need you the most, you know, what their problems are and how to speak to them to get them interested. There's this, the gap people need to cross is when you start your company and you get to the first few hundred thousand, a few million through word of mouth and referrals usually. That I would include if you get used like a friend introduces you to a reporter and you get an article in the paper, right? That's really like a referral based lead generation, right? And that's where you should start. But at some point you need to grow past relationships. You say, how can we reach out to people who don't know us, whether it's through marketing or prospecting? And that is much harder because when they don't know you, there's no prior brand, either from your company or personality or referral. Instead of giving you, you know, a lot of slack to get to know you, because if a customer refers them to you, they're like, hey, sure, I'll spend half an hour to like talk about what you do and find a fit. But when they don't know you, they're only going to give you this, like a fraction of their attention, a tiny slice. And you need to find a way to, you can find the right person and fit your messaging into like this tiny slice to engage them. So what appeals to people, and let's use cold email as an example, but could be through calling, social, whatever. When you send an email to somebody, there's like this, the crocodile brain or the dinosaur brain or the lizard brain or the crawling brain. There's all these phrases for the hind brain. It's very fast, like pattern recognition, like do I like this or not? And what appeals to it are things like details. What appeals to it are things like motion, right? This is why on online ads, you'll see, you know, color change, like contrast, like things moving. But in an email, what works would be numbers or specific like jargon or phrases like details. So I'll give you an example, what doesn't work, what does work. If you said, in fact, I just had a conversation with my, you know, we do a lot of outsourced prospecting for companies who aren't yet ready to build their own team. So we help companies create outbound success by, we can prospect for them until they're ready to build a team, and then we can tell them exactly how to build a team. I was talking to one, he was reaching out to technology people at hospitals to find out about how they can save money by moving to the cloud. And I'm just like paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. And the emails he was drafting were things like, who's in charge of your network infrastructure. Okay. All right. Pretty vague. It's maybe not bad, but these days it's too vague versus what he really should be talking about is who's the person in charge of managing your AS400 and I-Series mainframes and might be looking at sunsetting them. Right? It's a much, much more specific, tangible way, like a thing that resonates very quickly with your hindbrain. So I'll give you one more example. It's percentages are not like concrete numbers are better than percentages. We grew people's revenue 20%. That's not nearly as good as we grew people's revenue by $300,000. Because percentages, like the hindbrain doesn't calculate very well. As soon as you need to translate something to like what it gets, it just doesn't work. So the website, if you can, any kind of concrete details, numbers, jargon that resonates with people, like any kind of tangible things that always help because it appeals to this kind of hindbrain that is more about action than thinking. It's not about like a rational thought at that point. It's, should I look at this? And then, oh, I should, and then I'll read it, and then I'll think about it. But if it, the email doesn't resonate, if those details aren't there, they won't look at it.
So Aaron, earlier you mentioned what's in the first chapter of the book, and you mentioned that, you know, understanding the what or the niche is what that chapter is going to allow mm-hmm. you to do. Aaron, what are some signals that tell you whether you have validated or invalidated your hypotheses about who you're going after and what services you have to offer them? And obviously also the copy of your email, I would assume there, if people don't answer, then that means something.
Yeah. So what I was looking for, I know there's, you know, like six aspects of the crocodile brain in the book here someplace. So I didn't see it right away, but it's in here. So one of the clues that you've nailed the niche is that you have gotten customers who have just come in and are unaffiliated. It didn't come in through referrals. So in other words, if they bought your product, you weren't, so let's say that you are a website design company, right? And they didn't come in through referral. They didn't come in through, who knows how they found you, honestly. Or maybe they just saw a website and called you up. And in other words, like the product and the service that you did stood on its own. It didn't depend on your name, brand, referral, reputation. So if the product can stand on its own, and you also know the ideal customers who needs it the most versus where it's nice to have in the messaging, then you're starting to get to the point of, we've nailed a niche, we have the ability to go out and market to whoever we want to and actually make money that way. So that 10 of unaffiliated customers is sort of one guidepost. Another one is one other idea, here's actually probably a better way to think about it too, when you're sort of navigating this, is this need to have versus nice to have. And it's probably like the simplest way to start to understand how to better nail a niche. Because when we talk about nailing a niche, it's easier. You want to be a big fish in a small pond, right? You want to have a smaller, more targeted market and stand out in it. And the easiest way to do that is by changing the targeting and messaging. It's easier to make the pond smaller than the fish bigger. So in other words, it's changing your product and business model is hard. Changing who you target and how you talk to them is a lot easier. Restart. So how to better target would be looking at to what kinds of companies have we been a nice to have, where they were interested but didn't buy? And how are they different than where we've been a need to have, where they're interested and they need it and they bought? And what it is, because most companies aren't disciplined enough as they should be to say no to the nice to have situations and really focus as much as they can on where they're a need to have. So you're always looking for those differences. Like, let's go back to website design. Website design, you know, it's tricky because a lot of companies, it's like a slow change. It maybe happens every few years. Like, why do they need to do it? How would you find them? I mean, if they need to do it because they launched a new product, they would need it to do it. If they hired a new CEO or a new VP of VP of marketing, they're more likely to do it. They may not need it. If they did a brand, you know, redid their brand. So you're sort of looking at when is it nice to have? And also for some companies, a website's a nice to have, like a services company, you know, it's kind of nice to have. For an e-commerce company or someone that's like making money with their website, it's a must have. Like, so when they're, so you look at these factors, like when is it a top priority? What conditions exist for companies where it's like when they spend money to redesign their website, they get a real return versus, hey, you know, our website's kind of, it's kind of ugly, but we don't really need to change it. Or like, so how do you spot the differences? That's part of an example of that diligence of really digging into the differences between when you're need to have and nice to have and how to better target and message the people that would need you and find them. And so, you can apply that to product, to anything really.
Exactly. And Jan, for example, right now, Aaron, 70 emails in, I believe he acquired the first customer. And the topic, the discussion that we've been having is that in the beginning, really finding your ideal customer may take a few tests, may take going after different niches, all right? Not focusing on one specific potential customer that, you know, we want that and we know that. How many different segments do you think a starting sales outreach company should be going after until it finds what is the ideal customer for it?
Well, when you're an early stage company, you probably need, it's just really, you need some number of customers. It's probably in the 5, 10, 50 range, depending on who you are. And this first set of paying customers are really, it's another beta test. Because for most companies, when you get your first customers, some will work well and some won't. And it's not bad that some will quit or leave. That's part of that process. Because then you're like, okay, now I know, I have my A-B test. These customers were great, love them. They spent the most money, they were the easiest to deal with. And these customers were horrible. I don't want these, I want more of these. Now there's some more gray areas there, but you really are looking at that data set as you get your 10 customers, 50, you're like, okay, how do I now, am I smart about getting the next 50? And that keeps, that never stops. You get, then you get to 100 customers and, you know, some are working, some aren't, and you say, okay, well, instead of half my customers being bad, this time only 20% were bad. So let's, you know, redo it again. So that's that evolution of using the customers, and the attrition is a learning process, not that you're failing in some way. It's just like information. How can you do this better? And just knowing, hey, also a lot of things affect customer attrition. How you like, so targeting, which customers are you going after? What did you promise them in the sales process? That's a big one. The expectations. Do you on the right way? Was your communication like, what's your, so there's a lot of things that affect attrition. So you do need to look at, was this not a fit of a customer, or did we do something wrong too? It's like that learning process of an early stage startup.
So essentially, Aaron, it's like finding product market fit by just serving many customers within a specific segment, and then you focus on the ideal one.
Yep, basically. And then as you grow, you can have more than one ideal type, because if you're doing marketing, you know, you have sort of a company ideal customer profile. But if you're doing outbound prospecting, you have a subset, a much more specific ideal outbound customer profile. Mm-hmm. And so on. And you can have like ideal big customers, ideal medium. So you don't have to have one, but it's really about focus. Depending on the stage of your company, you're saying, where should we focus? And if you have 5 sales teams, maybe they're focusing on 5 different kind of segments. If you have one salesperson, they need like one, you know, 2 like key segments. So it's really just, again, this idea of specialization, sales specialization is one way to counteract, to fight the age of overwhelm we're in. Because we are in this age of like more just overwhelm, more content, more everything, and that's going to continue. And our sales teams, our teams and our customers will lose that battle unless we try to counteract it with things like focus. That's why, for example, if you haven't read Predictable Revenue, the book, and I mean, both books go into this, but the number one thing you can do to make your sales team work better is specialize your sales roles. That means if you have more than one salesperson, you have a prospector who prospects, a closer who closes new customers, a separate account management customer success team. And if you have inbound leads and inbound lead responder, because that way, if people doing fewer things better, rather than every salesperson is doing everything. I mean, I don't know any soccer team that would tell all the team, hey, all right, everyone go out and attack and defend. It doesn't work, but we do that with sales. Go out and then prospect and close and maintain them. And I'm gonna give you some leads too. It doesn't work. Now, if you only have, if you're the only person selling, you still apply the same focus, but you focus time on your calendar. You know, Thursday is a prospecting day, or Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So it still applies even when you're one person. But as soon as you have two people in sales, you should be specializing. I did this talk recently, and like one of the things these entrepreneurs really liked was that there's these four phases of the sales team. Because first-time entrepreneurs get sales hiring wrong a lot. So the phase zero is you don't have anybody in sales and you use some kind of outsourcing service. Right? And sometimes that's a good fit, sometimes not. But then if you're, let's say you're the CEO or co-founder and you're selling, the first hire in sales should not be a closer, usually. The first hire in terms of the least risky way to do this is a junior salesperson who will take over your appointment setting, whether that's inbound appointments or prospecting, okay? And then once you get that working, the second hire would be either a salesperson or a junior person, depending on, do you promote your junior person to closing or do you keep them as junior or hire a closer? But phase two is you've got the founder who's selling and a salesperson and a junior SDR or salesperson. The next phase, phase three, is you've got sort of two of each. You've got two closers, you know, there's the CEO, there's the two closers and two junior people, very typical. And then phase four is you hire a leader, like a VP or a director of sales. So that's kind of like this, you know, this phases where I think entrepreneurs hire closers too soon and they don't know how to hire the right one, or there's not an environment yet in position for the closer to do well, or they hire an executive too soon and there's just not enough there yet.
So Aaron, we talked about prospecting in the beginning, and now you mentioned closers. And what's the job of a closer, especially most of the time it's over the phone that you close a deal, because if people took the time to answer your email and were ready to take a call and understand more about your services and get ready to buy, what are some of the things that you have to do as a closer to close?
Yeah. Well, let's also make sure that people, again, there's lots of early entrepreneurs here, understand that sales is a life skill. You will not succeed in accomplishing anything in life without an ability to sell yourself an idea or a product. Because I think there's a lot of negative connotations with the word sell or sale. You know, if it helps, do you think the best salespeople in the world are Elon Musk or were JFK or Mother Teresa, right? Those kinds of people who can inspire people to do great things. So use that as your, so sales is a place where you, by hiring salespeople, you will make money. You're right. I know, again, there's a lot of companies who are like, well, I don't want to have to sell. I'm just going to create a product and people are going to buy it and I don't want salespeople. Right. And I think that's just based out of, you don't understand it and you're not used to it. And it's kind of this new thing you don't want to deal with, but you will make a lot more money with a sales team when it makes sense. And the purpose of that sales team or a salesperson is selling is, you know, obviously you want to help your company make money, but more often than not, a lot of customers need help buying. So educating customers, are you a fit or maybe you're not a fit? How would it work? What are the steps? How would they make money with it? Or how would they get value from it? They're all really important part of the sales job. So explain to the customer with your product, here's how you would use it. Here's how you would benefit from it. Here's how you would improve your company, your business, your life with it. That education. And in fact, sometimes pushing customers, like there's a lot of customers that don't really know. I mean, most customers don't really, they need help. They don't really know what to do. And you can't rely on them to make the best decision for themselves. There are a lot that do, like the early adopters and the entrepreneurial, hey, we're going to do this. But a lot of customers don't really know the best or what that area that they're dealing with. And a salesperson or you, part of your job is to help them understand what's right for their business, which might include them buying your product. And it's okay when you believe a person needs to buy your product to be firm with them, or to help, like, push to help them see the reason and to not get stuck in their fear or decision paralysis. And so many people do. Again, age of overwhelm means choice overwhelm, paralysis, what do I do, too many options. So a lot of your job is to help simplify things for customers to see, here's what you need to do to help your business, which could include buying our product, and here's how you would use it. And not being afraid of all this. It's not pushy, it's not manipulative if you're doing it right. You're inspiring people to make a change for the better and helping them get over their fears and decision-making problems to do that.
Aaron, actually, I'm so glad you divided the cycle and you helped me divide the cycle into prospecting, closing, and then maintenance, because now I guess we can continue to the last stage, which is the maintenance part. Let's start with the onboarding to begin with, onboarding the customer, especially for a small sales outreach firm. What's the right way of doing that?
Onboarding a customer?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're more than a couple people, nowadays in Silicon Valley, it's pretty common for, if you're up to 10 people, one of those people is dedicated to customer success. So customer success is, again, something I cover in the Impossible book, but it's probably one of the fastest growing kinds of job functions. Like, two really fast job functions these days are the SDR, like the junior sales role, like outbound prospectors or inbound lead responders, and customer success. So the philosophy is, you know, a lot of your customers won't know how to get the value, much value from your product without help. So for most of them, probably 90%, 80%, and 90%, you're going to have to show them the way. You're going to have to paint the picture. You're going to have to lay out the milestones. You're going to have to lay out the journey for them to not only buy the product, but get started with it and get value from it. Because if they don't, if you leave it up to them, most of them won't, you know, it's a lot of work to pick up a new tool or service and get value and see it. And a lot of them just will fall by the wayside. So it's really most of the responsibility, not all, but most of it is on you to help create a path for them, a process for them to sign up to buy, sign up and onboard and be able to use it successfully and become and see value from it. So if you have someone who you can dedicate to that, post-sale process is ideal. Right? Because if you need something to happen, you need one person and that's their job. If you want to make money with outbound, you need like a person doing that, you know, and who, like, that's the person, that's their job. If you want to improve your onboarding process for customers and create more, like, less attrition, higher retention, higher upsells, et cetera, you need a person who, like, that's their job. Like, who's, you know, it's on their name and it's their number one thing. But that's, I think the simple answer is, you have a person and it's their thing. And the other answer mentioned is, make sure you have a defined path for them to follow. And because you can't rely on them to figure it out themselves.
Aaron, my last question before I open the question for Jan, if you would like, obviously, to ask a question, Jan. The thing about, you touched on this earlier, Aaron. You said small companies in the beginning may not be able to afford hiring a sales team, sales outreach team. And most companies rely on administrative assistants, VAs, to help them do the job. What do you think about that approach for starting companies, and what's the right way of doing it?
For the outsourcing?
Yeah.
Well, outsourcing, it's a risky, it can be a risky proposition. Now, I mentioned that we do it. So, and you know, years ago, I was anti-outsourcing because I didn't see it work. So I think whether you're looking at software, any place looking at outsourcing, whether it's in lead generation, software, there's ways you can do it in a thoughtful way to make it less risky for you, because a lot of these projects fail. I'm sure many of you listening have tried an outsourced prospecting project, like telemarketing or emailing, and it just didn't do anything. I'm sure many of you have done software that just failed miserably. But many of you have had the opposite, where you had a successful outsourcing with software, successful with maybe lead generation. So for me, what I think it's important is to understand is, first, outsourcing. Should you do outsourcing or should you hire someone to do it? If you're if you want to be a simple company, which means you don't really want to hire people, you want to keep it simple, outsourcing could be a good way to start. If you are a growth company, which means you, especially if you have investors, you are, or if growth is the most important thing, outsourcing, you know, maybe it's a step, an interim step for 6 to 12 months at the beginning, but at some point you're going to need your own people doing the prospecting. So I think, hey, should you, in that case, you might just decide it might be better to start with your own team. Again, personal choice. But as you're evaluating this, I think part of the thing is you should look at, you know, three companies, pick some companies. They have good reputations and case studies. Find out about how they do it. Like some companies are all telephone, right? There's a company called Televerde that does a lot of telephone based. Mm-hmm. You know, find out about the industries they work with, but all over email, right? We found that having other people do phone calls is just kind of a risky proposition. It's easier to do email, but you know, some people specialize in phone. Depending on your market, sometimes email works better for your market. Sometimes the phone does. Like for little businesses, the phone is better than email. For enterprise, email can be better. Some companies do both, though it's kind of harder. So you're trying to find out these different companies, how do they do it? Is it a fit for your market? And I think the key thing is it's too easy. I'm going to go back to the expectations. It might take, you know, sometimes, for example, with our customers, we see some results within a few weeks. Or quickly. But sometimes we've had more challenging ones that take 4 months to like click into like a system. So you have to be prepared where whatever promises the company makes, whether it's us or someone else, or it's all guidelines. Again, there's kind of more challenging, less challenging. It might be, you have to be prepared for, say, 6 months, 12 months to be investing in this and improving it before you might see regular revenue. And that's going to be, it might be hard on the cash flow for many companies. So I think just being realistic about your expectations on how long it's going to take to see a financial cash flow return or a revenue return to this kind of any kind of project with outbound. So whether you outsource or whether you build your own team, again, it can easily be 6, 9, 12 months before you see much revenue from it. Mm-hmm. We have this kind of $1 million club, and we haven't written about it yet, but we have a lot of companies and they tend to do bigger deal sizes, but they do outbound. Whether it's through our outsourcing or whether it's our team building, where we tell them how to build their team, and they get no revenue for 11 months, 10 months, 12 months, and then they close like a $1 million contract. And we have a lot of examples of that. Obviously, if you're selling $20,000 contracts, it's different, but they'll sign up like a $300,000-$400,000 a year contract. So it's not common. So this is where if you really believe like outbound, like you don't test outbound. Hey, I'll do it for 2 months and see how it goes or a month. It doesn't work. It's like, if you want to get in shape, you'll say, hey, I'll try running for a couple of weeks. And if it doesn't work, I'll just quit. And so you got to be prepared to do it for say a year, however you're trying to, you know, define it and be committed to it, just like anything else important. Or if you're dabbling, you're not going to get results anyway.
Awesome.
If you dabble, you can learn some things, but you're not going to get any, you're not going to make any money at it. It's like when you go all in and you're like, we're going to figure it out no matter what. That's when it happens.
This reminds me of my conversation with Colin when he started before joining Predictable Revenue. He was talking about how he talked about the story, right? And I'm pretty sure you know how much time that took him to get to a point where he has a proven model that got your attention and got to a collaboration. Jan, you wanna ask a question?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks, Aaron, for your time. It was really a pleasure to meet you here. So yeah. I'm dialing from Germany, far away from your place. Not so good weather at the moment. I was also I read your books. The actual one I need to download. I saw that link on your webpage. So that's something as a next homework for me. But my question is, when it comes to email outbound, this is a thing which I discussed with Apto. This is which I would like to start with as my value proposition, especially for smaller, let's say UX design companies, UI design companies. This is the niche which I or the area which I picked as a starting point. And what I recognize over the years when you work with email outbound, if people come back to you and respond to you, I have the feeling that they are a little bit far in their decision-making process, and that you can also gain some quick wins, maybe not the big deals, but at least if you look at a smaller UX-specific design company where you can start with a POC work, for example, maybe you have, you target 20-25K as a contract value. I have the feeling that this is also possible. What is your experience in that? Is that something which is valid, or is it just my gut feeling that maybe this is that you can really get in conversations with people when they are far in their buying cycle?
Yeah, I mean, the trick with websites is how to find the people who are far in their buying cycle. So if there's ways to do that, because, you know, again, if it's like a 3 or 5 year cycle for website updates, it's kind of a little bit like a needle in a haystack.
No, I do not mean, I was not able to describe it in the right way. So when I, for example, with my hypothesis, which I discussed with Abdo, so I made an outreach campaign to 100 companies. Yeah. So mm-hmm. Now out of that, I have conversations now with five, and one is closed already. I think it took me 2 weeks roughly. Yeah. So what I mean, if what I recognize, and this is not the only example, if you have these kind of outreach email campaign, and people come back to you, that they are, maybe you hit them in the right time, yeah, in their decision-making process. That's what I mean. So that you can also gain some quick wins with such a campaign. So what is your experience in that? Just to comes to a cold email.
Yeah, well, and you know, getting five people to respond positively out of 100 is a really good rate for some markets. So, I mean, that's the whole trick, is how can you, people struggle with, especially in the United States, where email and the phone is just so overwhelming sometimes, how to stand out through the noise. We do see higher response rates internationally, across, you know, countries. Like, you know, email works in almost every country, but it usually works better outside the United States. Mm-hmm. There's so much in the States. So yeah, that's the point, is if you have a list of people you think would be relevant, and you can reach out to them with an email that's short and sweet, right? Not too long. People don't like long emails from people they don't know. And sometimes they don't like long emails from people they do know, to help start a conversation. And it's can be a fantastic way to find people who could be a good fit to get some leads and appointments, and to help add another channel for the business to drive predictable revenue through predictable appointments.
And okay. Jan, like Aaron talked earlier, I know Aaron has to go in a minute. Like he mentioned earlier, that it's almost like finding your product market fit. You go through a different group of segments that you test many hypotheses with. After a while, you'll understand the ones that, you know, he did like this, Aaron.
It was correct.
With the hands. And eventually you'll know which ones you want to work with that don't get you don't take most of your time and don't argue a lot with your work, and avoid those who are in the other hand. So that I thought was great advice.
Absolutely. No, I think this is a good point. I think it's also really important, what I recognize, that you, if I know, look out of the perspective, doing this for my customers, I think really this, knowing your niche, yeah, and really, really create a clear positioning and value proposition. I think this is also key for success. So if you have a Me Too web design company, I think then outreach will not work. Yeah. So this is also for me important to figure out, does the company have already a really clear focus and understanding of their target market? Without that, I think then you cannot reach our promises. As we said, we said, okay, out of 2,000 emails which we create or which we send specifically, we create 10 to 15 leads. But if that is Me Too message and service, I think that it's not realistic. That's it's also really important that you, what you described about that.
All right, that's it for the session. Our next session starts in exactly 1 hour and a half. If you'd like to join us below, if you'd like for us to use your idea or company as a case study, join below for all the instructions. We look forward to making that happen. Aaron, thank you very, very much for being here today. Thanks for the insights.
Yeah, but hey, thanks
Aaron, thank you very much.
Yeah, great to meet you.
Have a great weekend, yeah? Take care.